grieving. Some families will be lost to one another forever. To those of you who face the difficulties of reconnecting with family and establishing ongoing relationships, we say sorry. We offer this apology in the hope that it will assist your healing and in order to shine a light on a dark period of our nation's history. To those who have fought for the truth to be heard, we hear you now.
You're listening to Adopt Perspective, a podcast for anyone affected by adoption. I'm one of your hosts, Jo Sparrow. This podcast is a production of Jigsaw Queensland Post-Adoption Support Service. However, the views expressed are those of the people participating, not necessarily Jigsaw Queensland. The podcast discusses adult themes and listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Adopt Perspective. I'm your host and president of Jigsaw Queensland, Jo Sparrow. Today's guest is a mother who lost her son to adoption in 1971 and connected with him again almost two decades later. Jo Fraser is also the convener of the Victorian branch of the Association Representing Mothers Separated by Adoption, or better known as ARMS. It's a not-for-profit organisation formed in 1982 out of a common need to support women who are living with difficulties of having lost a child or children to adoption. She is also, through ARMS, part of the national alliance called the Mothers Adoption Loss Alliance, or MALA. Welcome to Adopt Perspective, Jo. I'm so happy to have you join us.
Thanks, Jo. It's nice to be here.
Jo, we're going to be talking a little bit about your personal experience to start with. Can you tell us a bit about your life in 1970 and your discovery that you were pregnant and what led up to your son being placed for adoption?
I was 16 and in year 11 at school, at a private girls' school, and had been going out with my boyfriend Robert for some time, I think more than a year, and he was 20, and I got pregnant toward the end of that year, and then in February my mother found out that I was pregnant. I had gone on to year 12, to HSC. I was actually practicing the piano one morning at 7 o'clock, as I did each morning before school. And she came in and sat down next to me and said, "Are you pregnant?" And I just couldn't say anything. I just sat there staring at my hands. And she said eventually, "Well, I guess that means yes." And I don't remember how the rest of the conversation went, but she did tell me that somebody had rung her and told her. I don't know who that could possibly have been. It certainly wasn't my one and only friend who knew at that time. Perhaps it was one of Robert's friends or sibling, I don't know. But anyway, as I say, I'd started year 12. And mum and dad, well, dad was furious. He was actually away for a couple of nights when mum broached the subject. And so she told him when he came home, and he called me into their bedroom the morning before I was going to school, and he just tore strips off me. He told me how disgusted he was with me and just went crazy. And so mum organised with two of my school teachers to, in those days there were only three terms per year. So I went to school until the May holidays, and then mum organised for me to do distance education, which I did for French and English. And then she organised for two of my teachers to come to our house at night once a week to teach me. And I, as well as learning piano, I was also learning flute, and I was doing both of them as an HSC subject. So I went to my piano and flute teachers' homes at night once a week. And we did that for a term. And I had Tim on the 28th of July, 1971, which was my parents' 20th wedding anniversary. And I had him in Queen Victoria Hospital. And I remember going into Mum's bedroom in the morning and saying, "I'm bleeding." And she said, "Oh, you're having a show." And I don't know if she told me that before, or I had, she took me to her gynecologist, who delivered me and delivered my three brothers. And I remember sitting in the gynecologist's office the first visit with Mum, and Mum saying, "I don't know how she could do this to us." And it was just as if I wasn't there, that the two of them talked. And then I went in by myself each visit after that. So when I went, Dad drove me into hospital, and she delivered Tim. I don't know if I've gone too far. Sort of.
No, you haven't gone too far. It's funny we talk about it in this matter-of-fact way, but the emotions that must have been sitting underneath everything at that time for you, I can't even imagine. Was there any talk at home at that time of you're going to be placing this child for adoption, or like what was the discussion?
I don't recall any conversation with me about it.
Mm-hmm.
I have said in recent years that I now think that I just went into little girl mode.
Yeah.
Once Mum told me, and that I just did what they said.
Yeah.
Oh, we had a housekeeper who used to come in. Mum and Dad both worked full time, and Mrs. Scott used to come in from 9 till 12 each morning, each 5 days a week. And Mum told her that I was pregnant, and asked her if they could pay her to stay till about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, not to work, just to be company for me, because they didn't want me to be by myself every afternoon. She told Mum that more or less sort of not to be too worried or embarrassed about telling her, because she had to get married. So, you know, she knew what it was like. And we actually formed a really nice relationship. Just used to sit in the kitchen and talk
yeah.
every afternoon for a couple of hours.
Yeah.
Plus I did my schoolwork, obviously. But, yeah, I don't recall ever being asked, "What do you want to do?" I can understand their feelings. I mean, this was 1971, and, you know, we're sort of upper middle class, you know, private school, girls don't do things like that. One of them, you know, their business partners, and I had worked over the school holidays in Dad's office. He was an engineer. And that's one of the things Mum said. All of the people that Dad employs know you, as if that made it worse.
Yeah.
Not that they found out, but,
yeah.
And yeah, it was all about people's perceptions.
Yeah.
There were, yeah, they just organized things.
Yeah.
And I just went along with them.
Yeah. So what was your experience like with the hospital and social workers when you went in to have Tim?
I don't recall seeing a social worker until I signed the papers, which was a couple of weeks, I think, 2 or 3 weeks after I went home. I was in hospital for 7 or 8 days. And then Dad drove me back in there to sign the papers. And I had a private room, so I didn't see anybody, didn't talk to anybody. I've had so many women say to me that nurses would come in and treat them really badly and say horrible things to them. Nobody ever did that to me. I do remember when I had, Tim was 8 pound 10, and I had a number of stitches. And I remember lying on the top of the bed one day with the heat lamp, with my knees up and then collapsed, like when you have a smear, pap smear, and lying there with this heat thing on me. And the cleaner walked in the room and just looked at me and said, "Oh, sorry," and walked straight out again. That's one of the few things that I remember from being in hospital, apart from my best friend coming in and visiting me, and mum and dad came almost every day, and my brothers came very often. And they're all there's only 4 years, sorry, 3 years, 3.5 years between the four of us, so we're all close in age, and I'm the eldest. So I've also had so many women say to me, "I sneaked out and had a look in the nursery," or "I walked up and down the corridor screaming and yelling, saying, 'Let me see my baby.'" It didn't occur to me to do anything like that. I just lay in bed, and I had an ensuite bathroom, so I didn't have to go out anywhere. And I was just in there for 7 or 8 days, not even considering that I could have done something, which I'm really cross at myself about at times. And sometimes I think, "Oh God, that's so pathetic. You should have done something, you could have done something, but you didn't. You just let everybody do everything around you." And actually, the presuming was a social worker who witnessed my signature. Well, actually, Dad and I went in there, and there was a man, and he said, that went through a whole lot of things, probably told me I had 30 days, but I don't recall if he did or not. And then he said, "Do you want to give him a name? It looks like you care more if you do that." And I just sat there. I mean, I was still a terrified little girl. And I just sat there and sort of nodded my head, and he turned the paper around, and he said, "What do you want to call him?" Oh no, he was going to write it in. He said, "What do you want to call him?" And I was sitting there thinking, "Well, he's not my baby, so I can't give him a name that I really like." And I thought, and I hope I don't offend anybody with this, but I thought, "No, I don't really like Alan." But then I thought, "No, Dad's business partner is called Alan. So every day Dad goes into work, he'll think of this baby," which was a fantasy, really, because that probably wouldn't have happened. Wouldn't happen. And then I thought of a couple of other names, and I was just sitting there looking at my lap, trying to think of these names. And I was obviously taking too long. And he said, "Would you like me to do it?" And I just nodded my head. So he wrote down, he said, "I'll name him after my son." He wrote that down. And then we talked, or he talked about a couple of other things. And then he turned the paper around for me to sign. And he, well, my surname was Stephen, Stephen. And he had called him Michael. And Michael has always been my favorite boy's name since I was a little girl. But I couldn't say anything. And he was called Michael Stephen. And that is actually my second son's name, Michael Stephen Fraser. And so anyway, signed that. When I got my papers back a number of years ago, the witness to my signature was Pat Cox, who was the head almoner at Queen Vic at the time. She was not in that room. There was a man there, and that was it, and Dad in there. So obviously she just had a pile of papers on her desk, and which is obviously fraud, and I wish that the woman was still alive, because I would love to confront her with it.
Just sounds like you're up against a tide. Like you said, you were so young and everything was just moving, and you just, like a child, was kind of like going on with it, whatever everyone was telling you to do.
Yes. And actually, I saw a letter that the principal at school had written to mum and dad toward the end of second term, and which went through to September, and he said that I would not be allowed to come back to school, and gave the reasons, which obviously weren't real reasons. I think they thought it was contagious or something, or I'd corrupt the rest of the girls. Anyway, he said that I was not going to be allowed to go back to school, and I just sat there and cried and cried and cried when I read that letter. I didn't tell mum and dad that I'd found it, but mum apparently went to one of the teachers that had been coming around, who was the head of the music department at school, and very high profile woman, and also very dominant in the school, I suppose. And when Mum told her, she went to the principal and she said, "If you don't let her come back to school, I'm resigning." So he let me come back to school. So I went back
Oh, wow.
toward the end of September, which was extremely good of her. And then, yeah, at the end of the year, I passed and got a scholarship to uni. So that's
So
going to say
that was
what
going to
wasn't
be,
all good, but.
yeah. Well, that was going to be my next question about what was life like for you following Tim's adoption. And so you sort of said what happened as far as school went. Were things spoken about? Did you talk to anyone about what happened? Like, how were you told to frame what happened afterwards?
I wasn't really, I don't remember being told anything.
Yeah.
Supposedly only my best friend knew. But of course, word gets around. And and Joss met me at the front gate the first day of third term and walked into school with me. And one thing she did say to me a few years later, and we're still best friends, we've been best friends for 60 years. She said, "I just remember you walking up the street from the tram stop and your legs were so thin and you just looked so frightened." And I was in the what they called the senior centre, which was for year 12 girls, studying one day, and somebody stuck a head in the door who wasn't in my class and said, "Oh, you're back. I didn't think they'd let you back in." And she didn't mean it. Oh, I don't think she meant it. It didn't sound nasty. It was just a, "Gee, surprised you're back." And nobody ever said anything to me, ever. Mum would give me a pot plant or something like that on his birthday each year. And there was one year I taught kindergarten. The only year in 25 years of teaching that I had that I taught a boy whose birthday was the same, the date was the same as Tim's, was when he turned five at kindergarten. And I had the roll at home for some reason, and Mum was looking at it and she said, "Is this boy adopted by any chance?" And I said, "No, he's so like his father, it's just not funny." But there was a incredibly ironic that in 25 years I had one child who was born on the same day as Tim.
Yeah.
But no, Mum did ask me once. We went out for a coffee one day and she asked me if I ever thought I'd look for him. And I was still not up to talking to them about it. And I just said, "Oh, I don't know." And we left it at that.
Yeah.
And Dad actually did. Dad did ask me, oh, decades later, when. Probably well after I'd met Tim, so it was probably 25 or so years later. He said, "Do you think we did the right thing?"
Oh, he asked you that.
Yes, and I said it was probably more than that because he was, well, he was 95 last year, and he was elderly, so let's say 15 years ago. And I couldn't say, "No, you didn't. You screwed up. You wrecked my emotions, all the rest of it." I couldn't blame them out loud. And well, actually, I said, he said, "Do you think we did the right thing about Tim?" And I said, "Oh, well, that's the way it was done back then." And he said, "That's not answering my question." And I said, "Oh, I know, but that's just the way it was done because I really couldn't do it." Although, interestingly, my youngest son, when he was about 5 years ago, mid-20s, and we were talking about an ex-girlfriend who had been physically abused by her father. And I said, "When was the last time this happened?" And he said, oh, a couple of months ago. And I said, why is she still going to visit him if he does this sort of thing to her? And he said, why do you still have anything to do with Grandma and Granddad after what they did to you? And that just absolutely blew my mind. It had never occurred to me that I couldn't or shouldn't have a perfectly good relationship with my parents. And we do. We have a very good relationship. Lived next door to each other until they went into care. And Tim is, he knows all the family. I know a lot of his adopted family. I was invited, Michael and I were invited, Michael was 3 and 4, we're invited to Tim's 21st.
Now and you are skipping ahead. Hang on.
I'm sorry.
I could just let you go because I'm so keen to hear about this. But
I was going to make a comment about, you know, family relationships, that's all.
Well, I will get back to that. Okay. So you said that you've had other children. I'm wondering how your experience impacted you as life went on, and obviously you went on to have other children. Has it impacted you as a mother to those children and in your life in other ways?
I don't really know. I have an amazing relationship with them.
Yeah.
We get along really, really well together. And I'm not too sure if losing Tim has sort of affected the way that I've brought them up. I do remember when Ben, my youngest, was a tiny baby. And I was carrying him upstairs one night in my arms to put him to bed. And I just started crying because I started thinking, because I was holding him in my arms.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started thinking, well, I never got to do that. And I did know Tim at that stage. I was pregnant. No, it was before I got pregnant with Ben that I met Tim. But just not thinking anything specific, but just realizing how much I'd missed out on.
Yeah.
I'm not having him around.
Yeah. Well, let's get on to reunion because I'm really, really keen to hear this. So you did, you were able to connect with Tim. Can you tell us about how that happened?
Yes. Well, I, when he was probably about 8 or 9 or 10, I wrote a letter to the Department of Community Services just saying, I'd like to know how he's getting along. I don't want to interrupt his life. I don't want to, you know, the usual sort of stuff. And I never sent it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote another one about 5 years later and I didn't send that one either.
Yeah.
And then the laws changed. And I remember hearing that there was a years waiting list, years and years. But anyway, I got in touch with the Department of Community Services, had the compulsory session, counselling session, as they called it. And she said, and Tim was 19, and she said, look, I don't know how long it will take, but I'll write a letter to the adoptive family and we'll see what happens. So she did. 2 weeks later I got a message from her saying we've found him, we've sent a letter, and he's agreed to have contact with you. And the incredible thing, I mean, they talk about thin threads and so on. He was actually doing a gap year after HSC or BC, and he was over in Perth with 2 friends from school travelling around. There were no mobile phones or internet or anything like that. This is in 1990. And he had come back home for 2 weeks, and that's when the letter arrived from the Department of Community Services. Because otherwise they most likely, well, it would have been a blank envelope. I would imagine they probably wouldn't have opened it. Anyway, he said, yeah, but then he went back to meet up with his friends again. And so I was given the non-identifying information sheet, told that he grew up in a regional city in Victoria. His parents were both health professionals. There were no other children in the family when they adopted him. and a couple of other things. And I also was given their name and phone number. So I walked one night, I was here by myself, well, Michael was in bed, Gary was out, and I just walked up and down the lounge room with the phone in one hand, the piece of paper in the other hand, just saying out loud to myself, just ring the number, just do it, God's sake, just ring her or ring him. And I finally did. And Jenny answered, and I said, my name's Joe Fraser. I don't really know what else to say. And of course, she knew who I was. And we talked for nearly an hour. And she said, explained that Tim had come back for a couple of weeks and then had gone away again. And then we had a couple of, oh, then she sent me three photos. And then we had another conversation when he came back around Christmas time. And she said, he doesn't want to speak with you on the phone. He wants to meet you in person for the first time. So we organised to meet in a restaurant near where I live, and we did that in the January. And he had grown up in, and the reason I'm saying names and whatever is that Tim is quite fine with me talking about any of this. He grew up in Geelong, literally around the corner from my paternal grandparents, within half a dozen houses of each other. And in a street across the road from my auntie and uncle. And none of them even knew that he existed. They died before I found him. So,
Those kind of coincidences I find a little heartbreaking sometimes because I hear them all the time, you know, where someone's lived close by or somebody ended up knowing somebody or you know, names that were similar in family. I don't know, just lots of strange things. And I find them, I don't know, soothing and a little bit heartbreaking.
Even going to school with a half sibling or something like that, just it's quite mind blowing, really. Those thin threads that you hear about all the time.
So, what has this reunion brought to your life?
Well, we have a great relationship. After he was born, I cried every day for I don't know how long. A long time. And then it was every second day, and then it was every few days. And then all of a sudden, I would get very emotional, and I'd realize that tomorrow's his birthday or something like that. We do have a really good relationship. He married a New Zealand woman, they met here, who is also adopted. And then they moved over to New Zealand, and we and my parents went over for the wedding. And then when the global financial crisis hit New Zealand, they sold up and moved back here. And then a number of years later, they moved back to New Zealand. So it's sort of been, back and forth and back and forth. So it hasn't always been easy to see each other in person. And very often I would ring and he wouldn't answer, so I'd leave a message. And then a week or two later, I'd ring again and leave another message. And then this would just go on and on and on. And then finally, when he did ring me back, which is weeks and weeks and weeks later, he would be really apologetic. And I was actually, I sent an email once, but I sent it to his wife's work email address because he wasn't good at emails and stuff at that time. Sent it to her work address and said, look, I don't know if I've done anything wrong. If I have, please let me know what it is. Because I talk to women all the time who've got relationships with their children, and then all of a sudden their son or daughter says, I don't want anything to do with them anymore. And that I really don't want that to happen, and really bore my soul. And I bounced back because she'd left that job. And then the next day he rang me. Purely coincidentally, and apologised profusely. He said Ange hadn't been well and whatever else, and we had an hour's talk on the phone. So, but that happens quite regularly. In fact, I'm trying to get in touch with him at the moment because my mother is dying, and I want to let him know. And he's not getting in touch with me again. So, but given that, and I've been told by adoptees in the know who help with support and that sort of thing, that that is not uncommon.
It's not.
It's just really frustrating.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think, right, that's it. I'm just going to wait until you contact me. I'm just going to leave it. And then I think, oh, what if he doesn't?
Yeah.
I get on the phone again. But
it's...
having said all that, when we're together, it's really good.
Yeah.
Really good. And he gets along well with my parents and the boys and everybody else in the family.
Yeah. Our paranoia can really kick in, can't it, when there's like gaps like that and you're thinking, have I done something wrong? Is this, you know, was it this or was it that? And then often, you know, maybe it's just somebody needs a little bit of a break, or sometimes, you know, adopted people are ready to dive into all things adoption and sometimes they're not, because it can be overwhelming sometimes, or sometimes you're just like, I can't deal right now.
Yeah.
And it can be as simple as that. And it's nothing that somebody else has done. Yeah. So do you have any tips for mothers who are considering reaching out to the child that they lost to adoption, or who are struggling during reunions?
Well, firstly, I would say just do it.
Yeah.
I know it can be really difficult. I mean, I have been incredibly fortunate in a lot of ways. One, that my parents didn't put me into an unmarried mother's home. They hid me at home, didn't actually mention that, but they hid me at home. And any time we had visitors, I went up to my bedroom. And if it was somebody who was likely to want to say hi to me, I'd go to bed and pretend I was sick. So, you know, they didn't send me off anywhere. And Tim was willing to have contact with me. So that was extremely fortunate. And we've got a good relationship. I mean, he's 52 now, and I met him when he was 19. So we've had a you know, up and down. Oh no, it hasn't been an up and down relationship at all. It's been a good relationship. So I am extremely fortunate, and I'm having spoken to so many women that have not had such good fortune. I'm very, very aware of it, but I feel really sad when when women say, no, I can't do that. I can't disturb their life. I'm too scared, or I don't want to, or you know, whatever the reason. And also when I hear adoptees say that they don't want anything to do with their mother, or that, well, she gave me away. You know, she obviously didn't want me. That all makes me incredibly sad, because more often than not, it's just not true. And it was a system. We, you know, so many of us had no choice. But with being in reunion, it can be difficult. It can be really difficult. One thing I always say to the women in the support group is to keep the contact up. You know, even if it's a Christmas card and a birthday card, at least, you know, the door is open. And they might even have to say that, you know, I really miss talking to you or something, but, you know, I would hope you have a wonderful birthday, and any time you want to reach out or ring me, you know, please do so. I just always think it's a good idea to, you know, keep that door open.
Yeah, good advice. What kind of support have you found helpful over the years?
Well, with ARMS, which I joined around the time I found Tim, I would imagine that the counsellor at CSV gave me a pamphlet, and I started going to the support group meetings. Then I went for a while, for quite a while. It was a huge group. And my only, apart from having some cousins who are adopted, my only experience with adoption was Tim and his adopted family. And we get along really well together, and they are really, really nice people. And some of the women in the support group, you know, the adopted parents were the devil incarnate. That, and I understand everybody has different experiences, and they were hurting, you know, but I felt really uncomfortable, and I wasn't as confident as I am now. There's no way that I could have sat there and said, well, listen, this is my experience. So I'm not quite sure, you know, why you're saying that. So I just stopped going, and then went back a couple of years later, and have been going ever since. And the women that come along to the support group are just amazing. So hurt and so powerless and so kind and loving and funny. They've been really great. And talking to a number of adoptees through Vanish or other people, they've been a great help as well.
So what can you tell us about other than your experience of being in it? What kinds of things do you do?
Well, we've been going, as you said, since 1982, so 42 years now, and we've had a support group meeting on the first Saturday of every month except January for that entire time.
Yeah.
So even when COVID was raging, we had it on Zoom.
Mm-hmm.
And so now what we do, we tried to just get back to, you know, normal support group meetings in person and have Zoom at the same time, but it just wasn't working where we were. So I now do, I convene the support group meeting, facilitate the support group meetings. We have the in-person one on the first Saturday of every month, and then on the third Thursday of every month, we have a Zoom meeting from 3 to 5. And that has meant, as happened during COVID, that we have women from New Zealand and Perth and Queensland and America, Scotland, and regional Victoria, as well as some of the women who actually come to the in-person group, but they also come to the Zoom one.
Mm-hmm.
And because we've made really good friendships, quite apart from it, and we'll talk about all sorts of stuff as apart from adoption. And so that's one of the things that we've done for 42 years. We also advocate a lot with politicians, federal and state. And we obviously we're always on the end of the phone or an email away. And I might go and have a coffee with somebody who is not into support groups. Or somebody who rings and just says, look, we've got pamphlets. No, I saw your pamphlet at the hospital and just thought I'd give you a ring. I've never talked to anybody about this before. Actually, I had a woman who rang a number of years ago and we were talking about it and had quite a long conversation. And I said, so where was your son born? And she said, Queen Vic. And I said, oh, same as me. And she just burst into tears. Because nobody had ever said that to her before. And I just said it because it was the same as me. But that just meant so much to her.
Mm-hmm.
So we, they're the sorts of things that we do. And we've actually, if I say it myself, we've done a pretty good job of advocating with politicians and so on. All the women that went before me and... I've been on the committee for, it must be about 12 years now. But there's so much went on before that. The walking in the streets with banners back in the early 80s, which, you know, most of us were hiding our heads under a blanket at that point.
That's it. And I know even from, we had like the 30-year reunion a couple of years ago, not reunion, sorry, 30-year anniversary of when records were opened up here in Queensland. And so I went back through all of the Jigsaw newsletters and minutes from AGMs and that kind of stuff from around that time. And something that really stuck out to me is how it was predominantly mothers back then who were agitating and advocating and protesting and all of those things, writing the letters to the editor, all of that kind of stuff. And things would move forward and then they'd come backwards, you know. So it was real full-on stuff. And something that's really stuck out to me is how a lot of them after that kind of fell away, and Jigsaw went through a change of people, you know, running it at that point, because they were exhausted. They were absolutely exhausted from all of that hard work, which we've all benefited from now, being able to access our records. And so a big thank you to all of the women and men who have put all of that work in over the years to give us the access we have now, and to the ones that still keep advocating now.
Mm.
Yeah. So what can you tell us about the Mothers Adoption Loss Alliance, or MALA?
After the Senate inquiry, the federal Senate inquiry, money was dealt out through forced adoption support services to be used in small grants in each state and territory. And ARMS has had a lot of grants that we've applied for successfully. And one that we applied for a handful of years ago now was to set up a national mothers support group, because and this was actually even before we got the redress scheme here, but that is a great example of the fact that every state works differently. I mean, we have been, again, incredibly fortunate in that we've got a government here who is right behind us and have been incredibly supportive, and but we want that for everybody. And so we thought that we would set up a national mothers group, perhaps as a type of support group for each other. The plan was, well, the application included having women from each state and territory get together on Zoom for a couple of meetings and then all come down to Melbourne for a four-day seminar and do all sorts of great things. And then COVID came.
Bloody COVID.
We've now had 30 meetings on Zoom.
Yeah.
Pretty much once a month. And we worked out our mission statement and our goals and all that sort of thing. And then started working on a number of things. And then we decided that really we were trying to do too much to begin with. So our focus currently, and will be for some time, I think, is to get a national redress scheme
mm-hmm.
up and running. We've got women on the committee from every state and territory except for, at the moment, Northern Territory and South Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And we're really pushing for it. We've been in touch personally and by letter and so on with Amanda Rishworth. Spoke with her when we went up to Canberra for the 10th anniversary. And that is really something that we would like to achieve as soon as is practicable. We know that it's difficult because adoption is a state issue, not a federal issue. But some of the wording that we've had sent to us or written to us has been positive. So we really want, and we're actually in the process of publishing some pamphlets to send out to different organisations in each of the states and territories to give to women to contact Amanda Rishworth so that she knows how many thousands of people are wanting this. And of course, it's not just mothers. We would like anybody who is interested in this to contact her. And we also want statute of limitations taken away, and a number of issues from the recommendations, from the state recommendations as well as from the federal ones. So we do know that we've got our work cut out for us, but boy, they had their work cut out for them in 1982. So
and
look what they've achieved.
Yeah. Fantastic. Look, where can people find out more about ARMS and MALA if they'd like to know more?
Well, ARMS email address is arms@armsvic.org.au.
So that's for the Victoria chapter, is that right?
Yes, we're just a Victorian group. However, they can, if they're interested in Mala, they can also, because those emails go to me.
Yes.
And they can just say that they're interested in Mala or they're interested in ARMS or whatever it may be, or anything else for that matter.
Yeah.
And my phone number is 0409 442 701. They can ring that anytime they like, not in the middle of the night. I have enough troubles.
You and me both. Jo Fraser, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your story and information about ARMS and Mala. And I know that'll help a lot of people.
Thank you very much. It's been an honour.
I'll put up some relevant links on the podcast notes page for ARMS and Mala as well. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. Meanwhile, do you have a story that you'd like to share with us? If you'd like to be interviewed for the podcast, jump onto the main podcast page of the Jigsaw Queensland website and complete the prospective guest form that you'll find there. And just note that Adopt Perspective can be and is listened to by people all over the world. Bye for now. Thanks for listening to the Adopt Perspective podcast. If you'd like to find out more, go to the podcast page on www.jigsawqueensland.com and you'll find a wealth of information and resources on the website. If you reside in Queensland, you can reach Jigsaw Queensland's Forced Adoption Support Service on toll-free 1800 210313, or you can call Jigsaw on 07 33 58 6666. If you live in another state of Australia, you can still call the Forced Adoption Support Service number and your call will be answered by the Forced Adoption Support Service in the state that you're calling from. In every other state, Relationships Australia operates this service. A big thank you to Matt Sparrow for composing and recording our original theme music. Until next time, I'm Jo Sparrow saying farewell from Adopt Perspective, a podcast for anyone affected by adoption. Thank you.